Good health is a crown worn by the healthy that only the ill can see. Your health really is your wealth. Join us for the next hour as we explore disease and attaining and maintaining good health. This is Dis-Chem Medical Monday, brought to you by Dis-Chem. Better health starts here.
And welcome to the Dis-Chem Medical Monday show here on 101.9 High FM. It's Monday, or if you're one of my bullies at Gebadelovo Sunday morning, Ronnie, I'm looking at you. And we've got an incredible guest on the show, and I'm really grateful that our fantastic producer, Sina Pabetsi, organized to get Dr. Michael Huth on the show. And I say this because I've got to know the doctor quite well over the last few decades, actually. And also, perhaps more importantly, many of his patients who speak very, very highly of him, decades later even. And it's always wonderful to bump into people, get chatting, and Dr. Huth's name comes up in conversation. So we're going to be chatting with Dr. Michael Huth. He practices out of Linksfield Clinic, and he is a neurologist, and we're chatting about stroke. It's something that's so important because this really is something that has a very profound link to time and getting dealt with it as quickly as possible. They use the acronym, which we're going to discuss with the doc, FAST, face, arms, speech, and time. What does that mean? Why it's so important? So stay with us. Let us have your questions for the doctor on our studio WhatsApp number, and that's 061-895-1019. We'll be back with Dr. Huth after these words.
This is Medical Monday, brought to you with the compliments of Dis-Chem. Better health starts here.
Dr. Huth, Michael, it's great to have you on the show. Thank you for your time. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Nick. It's a pleasure to be here.
And again, really, Mike, at least, you know, most of the doctors I call doctor, I have to be careful here not referring to you as Mike, because very fortunate that I've got to know you over the years and got to meet many of your patients. And it's such an incredible thing that you do. And I think it's so important that the public are made aware of the role that neurologists play, the role of stroke in our lives, what happens, and then the value of time. So firstly, if we could kick it off with, let's chat about FAST, face, arm, speech, time, and then what are the effects of stroke on the body, and we'll build the conversation from there.
Great, Nick. Thanks for your kind words. It's a pleasure to be here and to chat about stroke. Stroke awareness saves lives. And so it's a real privilege to address you and the listeners. You know, stroke symptoms that come suddenly, not gradually. That's why the term is called stroke, and the word struck. It's been called different things over the years, but they've always gone back to that original term, stroke, in order to make sure that people understand that this is an abrupt onset of symptoms. The easiest way to remember some of the important signs in order to recognize a stroke, Nick, is using this acronym you mentioned, FAST. The FAST acronym stands for face, arm, speech, time. So let's break that down for the listeners. Face. Usually in a lot of strokes, you may see one side of the face drooping, or a person may not be able to smile symmetrically. Arm, what does that mean? An arm or a limb on one side of the body might become weak or suddenly go numb. Speech, a person's speech may become slurred, or in some strokes, the person may either not be able to express speech or to understand spoken language. And then T is for time. If you see any of these signs, or someone who is with you that has any of these clinical signs, you must get medical help immediately. Time is of essence. As we say in stroke care, time is brain. And that means that the longer you leave the stroke until you get acute care, the more at risk your brain has of sustaining permanent damage. So just to go over that acronym again, it's FAST, face, arm, speech, and time.
When you say time, is it someone presents with one of these three things? And also, it's very important, as you said, not only the ability to speak, but the ability to understand speech, which I don't think is something that's commonly known. People, from my understanding and speaking to them, they know that sort of your face, one side droops, you go weak or limp on one side of your body, you have difficulty speaking. But I was not even aware that it was also referring to difficulty understanding. So it can affect your cognitive abilities.
Well, sure. So let's take, for example, the brain. On the left side of the brain, there's a part that controls language. And there's one part that controls the ability to express language. And there's one part that involves the ability to receive language or to understand language. So one would be used in speaking and writing, and the other one would be in listening, comprehending, and reading. And these parts of the brain are separated by some space. So one part can be damaged where the other part of the brain, Nick, is actually healthy.
Right.
And so let's give a common example so the listeners can understand. If suddenly you wake up in the morning and your spouse seems to be a bit confused, they don't seem to be understanding what's going on, they don't seem to be communicating with you the same way, they might feel a little bit off balance or dizzy. Okay. They might have a language deficit. They might have suffered a stroke while they were sleeping. And you'll only see the signs and recognize the symptoms in the morning when they wake up. That's called the classic wake-up stroke.
Right.
And it's that point where you use this FAST mnemonic. And let me just explain to you what it really means for the person in real, sort of real-world terms.
Mm-hmm.
When we say face, we want to say you ask a person to smile in front of you and you see if their smile is symmetrical. We say arm, you ask a person to lift both their arms and you see if both of the arms are equally strong. Speech, you speak to a person and you see if they can speak properly, if their speech is slurred, if their language is normal, and if their understanding is normal. And then time, and then you act on what you see.
Right.
That's what we want from people.
So it's more actually of a test that if you suspect, it's not looking, okay, the face is a bit off. You then start to bring in the arms and the speech as well. So it's a test that people can use to say, okay, we very possibly have a serious problem on our hands.
Exactly. You know, we're not so lucky in the stroke world as cardiologists are in the heart attack world. Why? Heart attack has massive amounts of symptoms and pain. Terrible chest pain, all kinds of other symptoms go with it. The person knows they're in trouble. People around them know. And quickly you're on your phone to Hatsola or to the ambulance. In the stroke world, the signs can be a lot more subtle. And that's why this FAST mnemonic was developed. So
right.
We try with stroke awareness to get people to be more aware of the symptoms and signs of the onset of a stroke, to act as quickly as they would in a heart attack, pick up their cell phones, get emergency care, and access emergency medical services as quickly as possible.
Okay. Would that be around getting them in the car and getting them to the hospital as quickly as possible, or to phone something like Hatsola and go through the stages and get a medical professional on the line while you're waiting for the ambulance, as it were?
That's a great question, Nick. And really, that question is not just isolated for stroke, but for any medical emergency. Doesn't have an easy answer. It really, in my opinion, depends on the context of where you are and what's happening in terms of the emergency. So, for example, you may live, you know, within 1 kilometer of a large hospital where and your person with a medical emergency may be able to still walk with assistance. If that's the case, it might be much quicker for you to put them in your car and to drive them quickly to the nearest emergency department. So really it depends on patient's mobility, your ability to transport patients, and your location, as well as a few other medical factors, whether it's better to go by private vehicle or whether it's quicker to call an ambulance. And one thing I must just admit, we are very spoiled. You know, thank God for Hatzola, and thank God for the wonderful people that work in that organization and how they respond, how quickly they respond, and how well they respond. But you may be in a situation or in a place where Hatzola is far away, and you may be reliant on an ambulance service or emergency medical services provider that is not as quick, and therefore it might be quicker for you to act and get the patient to hospital.
Right. There's a few questions still that I want to go through in terms of early stage and what's happening within the body. But I think this is the practical approach, and it's vitally important for you as the doctor, if someone is going to bring in a family member, a loved one that they suspect has had a stroke, what should they be telling the medical staff at the hospital that's receiving them as soon as possible to make sure that there's no misunderstandings, that they're not saying, okay, maybe it's low blood sugar as an example. I mean, that's me just saying that as a complete non-medical professional. What should they be saying to the medical staff to make sure that they're understood as clearly as possible? Because they very well clearly could be stressed and under pressure themselves seeing a loved one in this condition.
Also a great question, Nick. When I used to work in the United Kingdom, I did quite a bit of what they call A&E, the accident emergency. Basically emergency work. In the entrance and the reception of the emergency departments, they've got a massive sign behind the desk that says, if you have chest pain or any symptoms of stroke, please approach the reception directly immediately. So they want people that have symptoms of medical emergencies not to wait and not to sit down and not to be stopped or obstructed by a nurse or somebody doing triage, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So my suggestion and my answer to your question is, if you're accompanying a person with symptoms or signs of a stroke to hospital yourself privately without paramedics, your role is to go up to the person that is in charge of triage or in charge of access to the emergency department and to say to them without delay that you've got a patient with a medical emergency you believe is a stroke and they need to be seen by the doctor without any delay. They need to be prioritized. And that's very, very important because, as I said before, early in the conversation, time is brain. And every minute you save, you are saving thousands, actually, of neurons from dying.
Sure.
So that's the role we'd like people to play if they are not with paramedics.
And I think just to stress that point, when you say time is of the essence, you're not saying hours, a day. It's literally coming down to minutes and seconds, if I understand that correctly.
Absolutely. Minutes. Maybe we'll discuss a bit later about acute stroke care, but you've got certain window periods and you only have a certain amount of time when you can provide the patient with proper acute stroke care. And the earlier you provide it, the better the outcome and the less chance of complications from that care. So every minute saves lives.
That's absolutely vital. We're going to go to an ad break now. Let's chat about acute stroke care when we come back, and then we can go into what a stroke actually is in terms of what's happening within the body. We'll be right back with Dr. Huth after these words from these ads.
This is Medical Monday, brought to you with the compliments of Dis-Chem. Better health starts here.
You are listening to the Dischem Medical Monday Show here on 101.9 Chai FM. My name is Nicholas Engel, and I'm chatting with Dr. Michael Huth, and we're talking all things stroke. We've been touching on why time is so important, and we've actually, if you'll excuse my pun, given a great deal of time to this, because in conversation with Dr. Huth off air, and my understanding from what he's explained, time is, at the beginning of a stroke, the most important thing to take into account. Doc, is there anything you'd like to add on to what we've touched on time before we go into acute stroke care?
Well, just to act quickly, as we said, that's the point, that's the T in the FAST mnemonic. And just like we said, the quicker you can get the person to definitive stroke care, the better the chances are of having a successful outcome and of having less complications.
Okay. And that's literally, it's a matter of minutes. But if you're going to take the patient in yourself, let the carers at the reception, at the receiving know, the medical staff know that it is a medical emergency, that you think it could possibly be a stroke and the patient needs to be seen immediately. Don't sit in the queue. Don't take a number. Don't follow the usual process. Get them in front of a doctor as quickly as possible. Let's chat about acute stroke care. What is that?
Acute stroke care, a term used for different therapeutic strategies that are used to reestablish blood supply to the brain or reperfuse the brain, to use a medical term. I think this is a good time for me, maybe Nick, to explain to the listeners what a stroke is. So you can understand what I'm talking about when I say re-establish blood flow or reperfuse the brain. So a stroke is essentially a term that is used for a vascular problem that causes damage to the nervous system. Most commonly, this is involving the blood supply to the brain, but it can also involve other parts of the nervous system, such as the spinal cord or even nerves can undergo a stroke. But anytime there's a problem with a blood vessel, whether it's an artery or a vein, that causes damage or a problem or threat to a part of the nervous system, we could put that under the umbrella term of stroke. So let me give you some of the common examples, Nick.
Thank you.
When a blood clot blocks an artery that is feeding blood to a portion of the brain, that part of the brain becomes ischemic, which is the medical term for lacking blood supply and oxygen. So it lacks blood, nutrients, and oxygen. And if this is not reestablished, that part of the brain, those nerve cells, will die and the damage will be permanent. When the artery is blocked and the nerve cells start to suffer, that is when the symptoms begin. Up to a certain point, we can actually dissolve that clot or remove that clot and let the blood flow be reestablished and flow to that part of the brain again to provide those nerve cells that are still alive with oxygen, glucose, nutrients, etc. But nerve cells cannot live very long without oxygen. So that is why time is of the essence to reestablish the blood flow. So that is one type of stroke that is called a ischemic stroke or thrombotic stroke. And that is where an artery is blocked. You can also have strokes or vascular damage to the nervous system via bleeding into the nervous system. If, for example, you have a tear or a opening or bursting of a blood vessel and blood leaks out into the brain, what we call a brain hemorrhage, that blood will damage the brain. That bleeding into the brain will damage the brain. That's called a brain hemorrhage. That's a hemorrhagic stroke. Now, if we look at all strokes, about 80% are thrombotic or ischemic, and about 20% are hemorrhagic. And the hemorrhages can come from all kinds of problems like aneurysms that are there that burst, An aneurysm is like a swelling or ballooning of the artery due to a weakness in the wall that bursts. Or perhaps you have tiny vessels where their walls are damaged from long-standing atherosclerosis, or the vascular risk factors that, you know, cause damage to the vessel walls, and they can break these tiny blood vessels and you can bleed into the brain. But only about 20% of strokes are hemorrhagic, but they are much more devastating and much more catastrophic and dangerous, carrying probably a much more higher morbidity and mortality than ischemic strokes. Right. So we deal a lot with, on an almost daily basis, neurologists are dealing with ischemic strokes mostly. And the clots that blocks that artery can form within small arteries in the brain, or it could be a clot that is shut off from other places, like bigger vessels like aorta or the carotid artery in the neck, or even from the heart. It can shoot, a clot that forms in the heart can shoot up and block an artery in the brain and cause a stroke.
Sure.
So what we do, back to our topic, what we do with acute stroke therapy is we have established that we can, and this is over the last 25 years or so, we can use drugs to dissolve clots by thinning the blood. If we use certain medications that break up clots weak in a certain amount of time before enough of the brain has died, we can dissolve the clot and then blood flow can be reestablished to that part of the brain, and some of the brain that was going to die off can actually survive. Then what we discovered over the last sort of 10 to 15 years is not only can we give these drugs, but just like in the heart, where you can go in and do stents and do angioplasty and all these things with heart attacks, we can now go in with interventional radiological techniques and we can actually retrieve or pull out that clot and remove it mechanically. We can mechanically remove the clot and then reestablish blood flow. But what the research in these two areas has shown is that unless you do these techniques very early on in the stroke, you don't actually have any benefit to the patient. You can't really save the brain.
And when you say very early on, sorry to interrupt, when you say very early on, what sort of timeline are you looking at?
So we're looking at within 4.5 hours for the medication to bust the clots. And we're looking at ideally 6 hours for mechanical thrombectomy, but that can be extended sometimes.
Right.
It's very important to understand that although the cutoff is 4.5 hours, giving the medication or performing the mechanical retrieval of the clot as early as possible, say, for example, within 1 or 2 or 3 hours, gives you a much better chance of better outcomes and gives you a much less chance of the complications of these procedures. Right. For example, the later you give the medication to bust the clot, the less chance you have of getting a good outcome, but you also have a more of a chance of causing a bleed in the brain. So you don't want to thin the blood so much that you cause a bleed in the brain and then you hurt the patient that you're trying to save, which does occur in about 5% of patients.
Okay.
And same thing with the mechanical thrombectomy. So when I say time is brain, if you can do everything within an hour, what they call door to needle time of less than 60 minutes, then you have the best chance of really, really helping that patient.
Sure. Is it important for the caregiver, someone who brings the patient in, to someone who's noticed, hang on, there's something going on with my loved one, to also note the time? So hang on, this is what's happening. This is the time. So they can say to the hospital, to the doctors, this is, you know, it was half an hour ago, an hour ago, 2 hours ago that I first noticed this, and that's when we came in.
Brilliant question, Nick. That is so important. Thanks for bringing it up. Really, The doctor and the paramedic need to know the time of symptom onset, or in many cases, the time when the patient was last seen to be well.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, it might be that a person is seen to be well at 10 p.m. when they're going to bed, and at midnight, they woke their spouse up with symptoms of a stroke. So we need information like that to be able to establish where the patient is in the time window and whether the patient is a candidate for this acute stroke therapy.
Okay, got it. So vitally important, note, as difficult and as challenging as it can be, note the time. Something that I also wanted to ask, if someone is on their own and they suspect that they may be having a stroke, where they're able to call, what should they do?
Call an ambulance.
Call an ambulance. That's a, yeah. Okay. Got it. It is a relatively obvious answer. But you know, we have lots of people that elderly and so on, and even younger, that are on their own. You may not be with a caregiver, or some, a loved one. Make sure that you call an ambulance. And I suppose it's vital then to actually have the ambulance number pre-programmed into your phone.
For sure. 100%. I think a panic or emergency button,
Yes.
Or there are various different forms of this, with technology and wearables that have come about over the last few years. So you can see what you could provide for your family member who might be living alone or be elderly. But essentially, people need to be partners in their healthcare, mm-hmm. in terms of you should always keep somewhere a list of the medications you're on, a list of the diseases, your medical history, diseases you have. And then, like you say, you want the time of onset, and you want, obviously, an emergency contact person. Those are important things to have available at any time.
Right.
Because you never know when you're going to be, you know, needing those in an emergency.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, we're heading into holiday period, and we're a little bit off the topic, but I think this is still vital. What should people be doing when they travel to a destination? You know, getting numbers of hospitals. They may be out of a Hatzolah zone for those in the Johannesburg Jewish community that have access to Hatzolah, or the community that has access to Hatzolah. What are the things we should be doing? You mentioned keeping that list of, you know, of medication that you're on, those kind of things. We go away often, and we, you know, something happens, and then we don't really know who to call.
That's a great question, Nick. I think that anytime you're planning a trip somewhere, well, you know, not to sound too much like a paranoid Jewish doctor, but you really have to be aware.
An experienced Jewish doctor.
You have to say to yourself, what if? Okay, so what if, you know, you're going to go away, maybe you're going on a family vacation with children, maybe you're going with elderly people. What if something happens? And then you have to know, do you have a person's medical information? Are you able to provide that? B, do you have a plan of where the nearest hospital is and which emergency medical services provider is going to get you there?
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going down to the coasts, which city are you going to, or which town, and where is the nearest major hospital that can handle the medical emergency? And what is your route to that place? Of course, if you're going overseas, do you have medical insurance that'll cover, you know, medical care and those kind of things? Very, very important.
Right. And it's such a great point that you made, that you need to make sure that, you know, I think the huge life of impact, you know, heavens forbid, breaking a hand or a finger or something can be painful and problematic, but it's not going to have the effect on you that a stroke would have or that a heart attack would have. And making sure that if you're in an area like a small coastal town where there's a clinic that may not be able to deal with it, but do you go to the clinic and then they send you on, or, you know, do you try and get to the hospital? These are all things that people need to take into account. What would your advice be? Get to a smaller clinic, or try and make sure you get to a bigger hospital?
Well, unfortunately, Nick, we have a very large country, and mm-hmm. a lot of the holiday hotspots are quite far from major centers. So you won't actually have an option but to go to a smaller type of hospital. But that being said, you're probably never more than a few hours away by ambulance to a major center that could provide care. And then there's a lot of, depending on the type of emergency, there's a lot of air support in South Africa, helicopter service for medical emergencies. But this is kind of going, stepping a little bit out of my area of experience and expertise in terms of emergency medicine. But certainly I've been involved over the years of being a doctor in many cases where people that are quite far away from centers have been evacuated to larger centers, either by a helicopter or by an emergency vehicle.
I suppose it comes down to have the details of where you're going to be, and then where you're going to be will determine sort of the level of healthcare that you're close to. But whether it could be a top hospital or a small clinic, it's irrelevant if you don't have numbers and know about them.
But Nick, let me just add one more thing that just crossed my mind.
Please.
And it's also patient and context specific. So, for example, if you have a medical condition that may lead or commonly lead to a medical emergency, let's say you're a very poorly controlled epileptic or poorly controlled asthmatic, etc., then you don't go and put yourself 3 hours from the nearest hospital. So it requires a bit of common sense, you know, it's kind of safety first thinking.
Absolutely. It's such a great point, Mike, but I think it's when you say common sense, it's common sense that you have because of your experience with multiples of patients and understanding that what can actually happen. Because, you know, many, many years ago in a former life, I sold insurance, and people would say to me, yes, you always think about insurance because you're always dealing with it. But absolutely, you know, you're thinking about this as the doctor all the time because you're dealing with it. And it's such great advice. Don't put yourself at risk if you are already at risk. Don't put yourself at greater risk. You're listening to the Disc and Medical Monday show here on 101.9 High FM. I'm having a fascinating conversation and some really profound practical advice from Dr. Michael Huth, neurologist practicing from the Linksfield Clinic. We'll be back with you after these words.
This is Medical Monday, brought to you with the compliments of Dis-Chem. Better health starts here.
Welcome back, and thank you for joining us here on the Dis-Chem Medical Monday show here on 101.9 High FM. I'm chatting with Dr. Michael Huth, neurologist practicing out of the Linksfield Clinic. We're chatting all things stroke, and we just before we went to ads, I wanted to ask the doc about the risk factors that we face. And I think there are some that we sort of are common that everybody knows. You know, it's our diet, our smoking, our drinking, but perhaps also the very stressful life that many people lead, not necessarily out of choice. So, doc, if we can get into that, what are some of the risk factors that can lead to greater risk of stroke?
Well, Nick, these are just the basic cardiovascular risk factors that a lot of your listeners might know from all the awareness that has been done through the decades for heart health or cardiovascular health. And really, it's things like high blood pressure, diabetes, smoking, obesity, age, alcohol, and lack of exercise. And cholesterol, or very, very high cholesterol that's uncontrolled. So the basic risk factors that lead to poor vascular health also lead to stroke risk. Then there are other risk factors such as certain types of heart problems, heart diseases, certain types of autoimmune illnesses, and then certain types of either medications or other conditions, even, for example, pregnancy, which relate to more of us what we call a thrombotic risk or a very sort of clot friendly profile in the patient.
With the factors that are around lifestyle, so, you know, with pre-existing medical conditions, perhaps the patient hopefully has a greater understanding of the risk and they are looking to mitigate that through living hopefully a healthier lifestyle. Not to sort of pull out any numbers from you, but in your experience, how big a factor is lifestyle in stroke? So, you know, how many patients are the neurologist seeing that are having stroke due to lifestyle factors, overweight, smoking, drinking? I mean, how bad is it?
Well, let me tell you this, Nick. Once you've had a stroke, it's quite difficult to prevent a second stroke over the years. You need lots of medications, etc., a very healthy lifestyle, and there's still a very high risk. Before you've had that first stroke, if you want to start in terms of prevention, what they call primary prevention, by living a healthy lifestyle, you can prevent up to 80% of strokes.
Wow.
So theoretically, if you start from a young age doing the right things, controlling your vascular risk factors, up to about 80% of strokes are preventable. Prevention is far more effective than the treatment after the stroke has already happened. And the key, Nick, is controlling risk factors early, especially things like high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol, and smoking. Most stroke risk comes from probably lifestyle and health habits that are actually what we call modifiable. Some are not modifiable. So you cannot modify your age, unfortunately. We all wish we could. You get to a certain
yet.
Point, right, Nick?
Not yet, but you're working on it. Yep.
One day. But we wish we could modify our age, and we can't modify, for example, your male gender is associated with a higher risk. But there are things that are modifiable, and those things have to be screened for, and they have to be treated when they're found, such as your blood pressure needs to be checked, your sugar needs to be checked, your cholesterol. You need to stop smoking, you need to be in a good weight, and have you have to exercise, you have to eat well, you have to limit your alcohol, all those things are in your control. We can't absolutely control everything, but what is in our control, we should at least try and attempt to control it.
That is some absolutely phenomenal advice where, you know, we can't control everything, but that which we can, we must, we should. The reason I ask the question, and I ask it of many of our guests, because it has to be drummed in to people. And I hope that our listeners can take this to heart and understand that so much of their health is, you know, potentially in their hands. Because of lifestyle. And, you know, again, it comes down to the basic things: alcohol, smoking, your weight, your sugar, your cholesterol. These are things, as you said, we can manage through lifestyle. So hopefully, again, this point is coming across to them. And thank you for sharing that. It's just, you know, you control what you can, and don't start down that road of possibly having a stroke. And it's very worrying to hear that once you had a first stroke, you're on medication for the rest of your life, but your possibility of a second stroke is much greater. I mean, that must really be scary for stroke patients, but I'm sure hopefully a motivator for taking better care of themselves. What I wanted to touch on, and you mentioned men are at greater risk of stroke. What is the difference in the risks associated with both genders for men and for women?
So there's a higher cardiovascular risk in men versus women, most probably due to the amount of estrogen exposure through the woman's life. Once a female patient reaches menopause, that risk starts to level out a bit more in terms of vascular risk. But essentially, estrogen and the female hormonal setting is vascular protective in some way. However, I mean, that being mentioned, we should just touch on maybe a few things that for the female listeners. And that is that certain aspects of female life might actually precipitate stroke risk. And that would be things like, for example, taking a combined oral contraceptive. So someone is taking an estrogen-containing contraceptive, because those medications can provide increased stroke risk through making it more likely for blood to clot. And it's particularly problematic in terms of stroke risk when it's combined with activities such as smoking, or if a patient has a condition called migraine with aura, where a person has migraine headaches, has visual auras or some type of sensory auras before they have the headache. So those kind of conditions, which are quite prevalent in young females in their 20s and 30s, which is the use of the combined oral contraceptive, smoking, and also migraine, can often lead to an increase in the stroke risk. And we do see strokes in that population. Also, I did mention or touch on actually earlier is pregnancy, which is a prothrombotic state, meaning it causes more clotting. So pregnancy at certain periods can lead to clots. It's more likely often clots in, for example, veins in the brain. Now, I did mention that any insult or damage to the brain or threat to the brain that's caused by a vascular condition is called a stroke. And that doesn't have to be an artery. It can even be a vein. So you can have clots in the slow-flowing veins, and that's quite common in pregnancy. It happens in the brain. It happens usually towards the end of the pregnancy or just after, in the first few weeks after the baby's born. And that's quite a risky time for stroke in female patients. Also, female patients can also experience pregnancy-induced hypertension or high blood pressure due to the pregnancy, and that also increases their stroke risk. The so-called preeclampsia, if you've heard that term, most of the women will be familiar with that. And so there are certain conditions or times when a female, although they are protected in some respects, they may be more at risk for a stroke.
Sure. Thank you for that, Doc. It's interesting to see that sort of so much of this is related to different stages of life that are out of one's control. But again, coming back to the factors of making sure that you're healthy with regards to smoking, drinking, lifestyle, weight, and so on. Just to touch on, just before we go to ads, with regards to ladies, is hormone therapy a risk at all for later in life?
It can be, yes. It can be. It depends on the type and the patient and the need for the reason for the hormone therapy. But yes, it's every drug you give or every treatment you give, you have to weigh the risks versus the benefits. So it really depends.
Some great advice. We're going to go to ads, and then when we come back, Doc, I'd like you just to perhaps give a few pointers to our listeners in terms of, you know, people who have had stroke and have been treated early. You know, what is it? What are the quality of life like for them? And then any points that you'd like to finish on, perhaps drumming in again how important good, healthy lifestyle, which really is the whole gist of the show. Its purpose is to get people to live with good health. As we say, you know, good health is a crown worn by the healthy that only the unhealthy can see. We'll be back after these words with Dr. Michael Huth.
This is Medical Monday, brought to you with the compliments of Dis-Chem. Better health starts here.
You've been listening to the Dis-Chem Medical Monday Show here on 101.9 Chai FM. I've been chatting with Dr. Michael Huth, neurologist, and we've been talking all things stroke. Doc, really grateful for your time and everything that you shared. I think the practicality of the advice that you've put out there and the information can really be profoundly life-changing to people in preventing, hopefully, stroke and just enhancing their quality of life. With the patients that you've seen that have had early treatment, that have gotten to medical care early, what is their quality of life like? Hopefully we're not giving just a doom story, perhaps some feel good to wrap up the show.
Okay, Nick, let's talk about the research findings of patients who access adequate acute stroke care. So this means that patients get to hospital in time, they get to definitive treatment in time, and within the time window, they get given either the clot-busting drugs or mechanical thrombectomy. And what we're doing as doctors when we provide this type of care is we are not stopping the stroke from causing damage to the brain. We are not going to have saving the patient. All we're doing is improving the chances of the patient having the best outcome. So let's say, for example, the best outcome is a patient who is able to leave the hospital walking, talking, swallowing, understanding, and able to live life without much impairment, without much disability, and without much what they call participation restriction. And if we look at all the patients who have a stroke, an ischemic stroke, this is not for hemorrhagic stroke, which are the bleeds, this is for ischemic stroke. Out of the 100 patients, okay, you have 100 people that have had a stroke. 10 of those patients will have this type of best outcome.
Sure.
Quite sad that. Very. That's not your silver lining. 10 patients out of 100 will be able to leave hospital as I described. 90 will not. If we do give the treatment adequately in the right amount of time, as early as possible, and we don't have complications from the treatment, we can increase the number from 10 out of 100 to anywhere from 30 to 40 out of 100. So we're not saving a person. We're not erasing the effects of the stroke. We're not reversing anything. What we're doing is we're improving your chances of having the best outcome.
I think that's a great way to end the show and to wrap up, because it's stating the seriousness of the condition and the importance of getting medical treatment, medical care, appropriate medical care, as you said, Doc, as soon as possible. Dr. Michael Hu, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been absolutely fantastic chatting to you. Some, as I said, incredibly vital and practical information. You've been listening to the Dis-Chem Medical Monday Show here on 101.9 Chai FM. Thank you for joining us. Thank you to our fantastic producer, Sina Pabeti, for putting the show together. Thank you to our controller, Craig, for pushing all the red buttons, as Benji says. And thank you to you, the listener, for joining us. I look forward to chatting with you next week.